Hello and welcome to The Leap of Faith.
When I started this work, I was very much hated for sitting with dying patients and making the hospital famous for dying patients. And a decade later, I received so many doctor degrees, I can't even count them. And I don't understand that because I've never invented anything. I've never done anything except sit with people and listen to them and hear them.
The voice there of the late Dr. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, who died in 2004, a Swiss-American psychiatrist and a pioneer in near-death studies, and the author of the groundbreaking book on death and dying, where she first discussed her theory of the five stages of grief.
I bring all my dying patients home. It's a very different kind of dying than being in an intensive care unit hooked up on tubes and respirators and monitors and machines, where the relatives can only come in 5 minutes every hour. To me, the quality of life at the end is incredibly important because the memory for those who are left behind are a great contributing factor how they're going to go through the grief period. And if they know that they have been at home and have loved them and have contributed to the happiness of the last few days, they don't have all these guilt and shame and fear and, oh God, if we had only done this or that.
She couldn't understand why, out of sheer natural curiosity, we weren't interested in speaking more about death, because it was the one thing we're all sure of. In working with, she worked a lot with dying children and with dying patients, and she said the greatest tragedy was that they couldn't be heard in their grief. If they wanted to speak, if people around them, say doctors, medical professionals, if they weren't able to hear their pain, they were left, they had all these people around them, but they were totally isolated with it.
And that's Dr. Mary Stefanazzi, counsellor, psychotherapist and specialist in dealing with grief, who studied with Dr. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross.
Elizabeth Kubler-Ross was a Swiss psychiatrist and a pioneer in the area of death and dying, opening conversations about it. Her early life, she grew up as an identical triplet in Switzerland. And it's, she just talks about death as the first stage is denial, people denying it. But her first experience of denial was she was a triplet. Her mother was giving birth. The doctor delivered the baby and was going away, and the mother said, come back, I think there's another one. So the doctor was saying, outrageous woman, and reluctantly came back and delivered the second child, then went to go away again, and the mother called her back and said, hello, I think there's another one. And the third triplet, being Elizabeth, was born. And she talks about in her early life being an identical triplet, the lack of identity, and that only her beloved pets knew the difference. She said sometimes the parents, because they were identical, that there was one on one lap and one on the other, and they didn't know which one they had on their lap. They didn't authentically say, I don't know which one are you? So it was only her pets who knew her. So that was her first experience of denial and the lack of identity.
What of a Christian, but she found herself involved with people through the Holocaust movement.
She did. She often quoted, she said that in everybody there's a Hitler and a Mother Teresa in all of us. So her aim in her work, particularly her residential workshops, was to encourage people to confront the Hitler in us. Because the same as what Carl Jung would have said, like, she was concerned about that shadow aspect. If we bury that and pretend we're all sweet in the surface, we're in danger because that goes underground. So she was very much about encouraging people to confront that. And there's nothing like death to bring up those issues. Her greatest revelation, I think, was a woman she met, and she talks about visiting the concentration camps in Majdanek. And she met a woman there, and she couldn't understand all the people in this woman's family had been killed by the Nazis, and she couldn't understand why she wasn't bitter. And the woman says, you know, I'm no different than Hitler himself if I hold that bitterness. That was her opening of how we work with the pain we've suffered and work through it, not dismiss it or write it off, how we work through it so it doesn't have a hold over us. So then she began these residential workshops, which were quite innovative, and at the time was to get people together and basically cook them for a week, in week intensive, where she'd have one person would come up, say 80 to 100 people residential for 5 days. We'd work late into the night, and somebody would share their pain, and one people would tell the story of whatever was troubling them, and half the room would probably be in tears or be angry or whatever. And then if people needed to work personally, there was a team of staff then that if people got triggered by what one person was saying, but it was a gift one person gave by authentically sharing their story. And also Elizabeth's aim was to encourage people. She was particularly focused on medics, on doctors, nurses, anybody who was working with people who were ill or vulnerable, that if they haven't heard, gone through their own pain, it doesn't have to be the same story, but if they haven't gone through their own pain, they can't be there for another. There's no teaching, there's no qualification, there's no accreditation can deal with that. So she used to describe putting her staff through a tumble dryer, or it was like polishing a diamond, she says. If you've worked through one issue, she'll kind of rise you till the next comes up. And it was like that continuous process of polishing, she said. Every issue we deal with, now we can increase the depth that we can hear another person.
She's credited with the early hospice movement. Is that a fair credit for her?
I'd say her, because her work was about living until you die. So the ethos of the hospice movement is all of what she said. Like a colleague who brought me on a tour of the wonderful hospice in Raheny in St. Francis, and you know the doors, the French doors open out to the garden, beds can be wheeled out into the garden. That would be if people want to be outside. So that's very much Elizabeth's ethos, that it's how we live. So she was very much in favour of bringing people home, hugging them, touching them, having their pets crawling over them, and you know that they can be in that setting. And if they can't physically do that, is that they can do it at home.
The legacy of her work is still quoted by people, and often not even times knowing who the author of it was. What is the Kubler-Ross model?
She talked about the stages of dying, like the denial, it's hard to face it, and we talk about denial all the time. There's five stages: the denial, the bargaining, acceptance, anger. That anger, I think, is the biggest one. We're, however comfortable we are with grief, if we're in tears, but anger we don't realise is part of grief. But recently at a symposium in Trinity, I realised that, or I presumed her work was still being taught. I was kind of shocked to find it wasn't. And I was reliably informed that there's this idea of her work is dismissed because it's the stage theory. Some theory about of this, because she talked about stages. But when she wrote her book about death and dying and described the stages, it was never intended that there would be like a chronological stage you go through A, B, C, D in that order. But in order to write and to teach, you have to put some structure in your thinking. So there was no intention, or it was never, it's a process of grief. Like, for example, in clinical work where I'd see it, a person may not come in and say, I'm grieving and I'm at stage whatever. But people might come in and say, I'm at work and I'm fighting with everybody. They're all driving me mad. So, you know, so obviously anger is the issue. So I'm not going to go down the route of anger. I'll say, well, tell me about your story of loss. And you might tell me a story of a series of a lot of losses. So that's where her work has benefited in clinical practice, regardless of what the current thinking is about stage theory. It kind of flags grief in areas where you're not coming in and naming that. After anger, there's bargaining. You know, you hear people talking about doing deals with God or deals with our children particularly. I'll be good if you save daddy and mommy. Depression and acceptance. Acceptance, you could say, is the final stage. So it's never accepting that diminishing the person who's gone or whatever the grief is. Acceptance is that it doesn't fire us. We can speak about being upset, or we don't have to avoid it. The depression is another one I think she'd be very angry with if she was around now. That depression in the sense of the literal meaning of the word depression. When we're in grief, we are depressed. Our life force, our energy, our vitality is depressed. It's unfortunate that that word now has a clinical connotation. It's a pity there's not a different word for whatever the clinical manifestation is. But the depression, so that lethargy, that lack of energy, when people don't need to talk, they just need somebody to come in and cook a meal to wash up for them and do the basic things, because you don't have the energy, or the energy of somebody coming in, even doing it with you. It's not all about talking about what happened. It's the practical things are very difficult when your energy is that low.
How did she approach her own death?
She fought, kicking and screaming, I'd say. She got what she most didn't want, to be incapacitated, to have a, you know, and she used to always say that, the idea of being helpless and having to be cared for. So, and she'd often say that what you wish for, what you most need, you'll get. So she had a tough time. But she would have worked with it, she would have given out, she would have given a good run to the people around her, you know, that it was, She was the most human person I think I ever met. She didn't, for particularly somebody with such a prestigious, I had this image of this tall Swiss woman who was going to walk in very elegantly dressed when I had read about her before I met her. Like, I wasn't expecting this small woman in a polo neck and smoking cigarettes to arrive in. But the human quality that when you met her and heard her speak was, I've never met it in anybody. So,
for you as a practicing therapist, there's a significance to her work. And yet at the same time, towards the end of her life, she started to talk about spiritualism and the idea of the afterlife and even threatened to come back to some people and haunt them. That brought her work into disrepute ultimately.
Yeah, I'd say it did. I mean, it's reasonable. You see people going, when people are closer to the end, there's that part of us that doesn't want to let go. But I think more than anybody's thought, it has to be taken in context. And also when you strip away the layers of your personal story or personal pain, you're going to come to the deeper aspect. And really, depending on your, she grew up in the tight Protestant community. So the deeper questions that she wanted anywhere she met or people around her. And then you must remember she lived in California where, you know, as she used to describe herself, the flaky Californian. So, you know, you have a lot of exposure to that. So if she was in West Virginia compared to California, what is even accessible if you're asking those questions? Whereas if you're here in Ireland in certain parts and asking those questions, you may talk to your local priest. So I think everything has to be put in context. But it's very easy for academics to ridicule somebody if they pick something like that out of context. Not everything fits the academic rigour, but I don't think it means that it's not up to the quality of the standard of our research. Not every system meets certain research criteria. So dealing with the human condition and the pain of death and dying, you know, don't tell me a certain scientific analysis will meet that. Jung came up with the same problem because his work didn't fit. So it's not to go against the academic rigour, but it's to see how can we accommodate the complexities that don't fit neatly. The human condition doesn't fit neatly into a lot of structures, but that doesn't warrant it been ignored or not investigated and not discussed in these circles. When I signed up for the workshop, I think it was in May, I signed up for the workshop and didn't really know what it was about. The workshop was on in August, but in that interim period, my own mother was diagnosed with cancer. You know, she was diagnosed for the second time, so she was in her latter stages. But it was through what I learned from Elizabeth, I couldn't have heard things she said other than that. Elizabeth talked about the symbolic language. She would say a dying person is going to say, oh, I'm dying, I want to talk to you about it. But they use the symbolic language. They might drop hints, but a lot of us, I think, miss those hints. Like, I remember my mother died over Christmas and I was in town a few days before Christmas with her shopping, and she bought something for my sister and she said it'll be a souvenir for her. Now, I wouldn't have heard that before. You know, a souvenir isn't something you normally say with a Christmas present. So it was like, at some level, she used to say that every dying person, even somebody in a sudden death, knows they're dying at some level, not at a conscious level. And that's where it comes out in the symbolic language. So she used to describe herself as a translator. So I wouldn't have heard that. I would have missed that before. And I'd hear it in my work with clients sometimes. It's in the side remarks, the throwaway comments where people say what they don't even realise they're saying. So that's what opens the doorway to really hearing. So it was a great help to me as my mother was dying and as my father was dying that you could have those conversations.
What is the significance of her work?
I think extraordinary, but I admit I'm totally biased. I think she opens a level of humanness from a practitioner. It's generally there's the practitioners, the experts, and then there's the people who are talking about the human level. But to meet that level of human distress from somebody so in circles where she could be heard. She had her medical training, she had her prestige to get an audience. If you or I said the same thing, we wouldn't have had the audience. So I think that's the mark of her success. She used her position to bring the importance of the dignity of the human person, that people could die with dignity, could live with dignity. She came in here into the health service and saw what was happening. She would rise ructions and it's amazing more people don't.
We pride ourselves in Ireland with the phrase, we do death well in Ireland. Would we pass Elizabeth's test on that same thing?
I'd have my doubts. We do the hooly well. We do the party well. We'll turn up and we'll be seen at the funerals. But I don't know if we do the dying person well. I mean, if we can, I think when we're, come back to before we're dying, when we're healthy, do we really hear one another? We do a lot of talk, but do we really listen? That's the part. I think Elizabeth was a wonderful listener. She just totally listened. Similar to what Jung did. Even if she didn't understand, she listened. She listened to dying children. She got them to draw pictures. It was like the ultimate in, you could say, a prayerful presence, what we'd read about in religious texts as a presence or a spirituality. Hers was in the everyday. I think we're good at tripping into the prayer, but how good are we in sitting with the pain of another? So that was her gift. And she would stick your head in it. If you were working with people and you didn't want to see it, she'd do anything to get you to see it.
And that's Dr. Mary Stefanazzi, counsellor, psychotherapist and specialist in dealing with grief. And finally on the programme this evening, we learnt of the death on March 21st of the Reverend Dr. James Good. Father Good was a guest on our programme back in January when we spoke about the impact of Humanae Vitae on his life. Here's another opportunity to hear that conversation.
Father Good, would you set the scene for me for 1968? What it would be like for somebody when this was being discussed the first time, Humanae Vitae?
Yes. 1968, priests heard confessions for 3 hours every Saturday night. 3 solid hours, and the average time was 1 minute. So you had 60 multiplied by 3, and the vast majority were contraception. There was a phrase in Dublin which you got nearly every confession: "Father, I had misconception with me husband." And of course the rule of the church said this is immoral. Avoidance of conception is a mortal sin on every single occasion. And you know then, it was a Catholic doctor invented the pill, Dr. John Rock, 1964, and the Pope Paul VI immediately set up a big commission. And they were nearly all conservatives, and they all changed their minds. The commission were almost unanimous in saying it was time for the church to change. And Paul VI added more conservatives, and they changed their minds too. And there was almost a unanimous verdict eventually that it was time for the church to change her views on contraception. And Paul was pretty well known, he's very scrupulous. He was very, oh, I couldn't possibly do that. And he went to a lone Jesuit and told the Jesuit to write an encyclical in which no change would be the basic principle. And that is how Humanae Vitae came to be. That contraception was immoral on all occasions, and there are no exceptions.
Now, 1968, yes. You were here in Cork, you were 44 years old as a priest, and it was Vatican II, the world was changing, there was a new feeling coming around the place. What actually happened then at a grassroots level?
Many left the church, and there was a big drop-off immediately in confessions, and I would say that the vast majority of Catholic married couples, what we would say good Catholic married couples, ignored the encyclical. And that was the feeling that I got at the time. And the other area I was involved, you see, was I was lecturing medical ethics in UCC, and I had a kind of a medical background. And my medical background told me that there had to be some method of limitation. And it was all the safe period at the time, you see. And apart from all the other problems of the safe period, you had the problem that it killed off the spontaneity in married love. And it destroyed what was a penance now here in confession in those days. As more and more people said, this law is not possible, we cannot keep it, and therefore we continue contraception. The Catholic family simply just ignored the encyclical.
What was the reaction locally from parishioners, from lay Catholics in Cork, when you spoke out against Humanae Vitae?
I suppose I was regarded as, you know, an odd bod, really, you know, and like, what does he know about married life? And at the same time, I knew from my hearing confessions in Cork and Limerick and my few years there and my earlier years in Dublin, that was a big single problem in Catholic lay life at the time.
This had a direct impact on you because you spoke out in 1968, and your bishop called you to task.
He had to. Now, I would think, looking back over the years now, he probably agreed with me. He was a very liberal man in many ways. And he called me up and he said, look, all I would ask from you now is a private, personal withdrawal of what you have said, and we'll forget about it. And I said, I'm sorry, I cannot. This is my conscience. And he said, well, I'm terribly sorry. Then I have to withdraw your diocesan faculties. Now, that meant no preaching at Mass and no hearing confessions. I had 2 years in the lock, saying 7 o'clock Mass on a Sunday morning, read the Gospel, turn around, and no preaching. And then confessional, of course, people were still going to confession in those days, and I had to be absent.
This is Bishop Lucy we're talking about, and of course this was a man who you were to meet many times after this.
He was known as a pretty conservative, and people accepted this. This was the bishop of the diocese announcing the church's view, and he just had to do what I was heard later, that the nuncio was breathing down his neck as well. Silence this fellow. And then I decided that I wanted to go to Africa, and I just went out on a holiday. And I was friendly with this man in Turkana Desert in Kenya. And I went out on a holiday to him, and I said, would I be any use to you? He said, you're most welcome here. And as it happened, he did the one thing that was necessary, building hospitals and homes for, you know, they'd know, well, providing food for the people and so on. And he did the building process with his own two hands, electricity, plumbing, everything, and I ran the diocese. I had 24 great years there.
Did you hold any resentment for what had happened to you in Cork?
None, actually, because I knew that Lucy was under pressure to silence me, and I was fully aware of the seriousness of what I was doing and that he had no other option. And he never showed any hostility whatever. And then, as you know, the surprising thing, he had this big mission in Trujillo in Peru, and when he retired, everyone assumed he'd head off for Peru. And the next he announced to me he was coming out on a holiday to me. And I took him all over the desert, gave him a good run around. And the next thing, as I was sending, letting him go home then, say goodbye to him, sending him home to Cork, he said, I'm trying to talk to you. Three things. Number one, I am coming out here as a missionary. Number two, you are to arrange it with the bishop. And number three, I am demanding an appointment where you are working. It's unbelievable. I'm 20 miles out from the nearest bit of civilization, you know. And he came out at the age of 78 and worked day and night for 2 years with me. And we were inseparable.
Did you ever talk about it with him in Kenya?
Never discussed at all, except on one occasion, I think I mentioned that in passing. I think he said, look, I think you should go back and work in your own diocese. You shouldn't be out here in the desert. And I said it was part of his own regret and his sadness at thinking that he had wronged me. And he hadn't.
Father Good, was the Humanae Vitae the end of the Roman Catholic Church's influence in family life on, at such an intense level?
I would think very much so, because, you see, that remained in the Code of Canon Law until the Pope they issued a new edition of the Code of Canon Law in 1983. And that is the one that is ruling the Church now, but it isn't of the same level of importance. And after Vatican II, of course, it's a kind of a dead duck.
You're 70 years a priest.
Yes.
What's your observation of the a health check on the Roman Catholic Church in Ireland now?
I think that the keeping the law of celibacy strictly is going to kill off the priesthood. And in a few years, there will be no priest there, because generations coming along now are not prepared to accept celibacy.
And for you at 94, how have you managed the loneliness?
Frankly, I find it quite difficult. I'm a normal, I can say, heterosexual man. And I've had several near misses with ladies. I had, in Kenya, I had a lady who actually flew several hundred miles on bended knee. Would I marry her? But I would have to become a liberal Methodist before doing so, you know. It was inevitable. And I miss the whole concept of companionship and sexuality. And I've, quite frankly, found it quite difficult.
With news of the possible visit this year of Pope Francis to Ireland, how do you think that will go down?
I say he gets a lot of, you know, adoration and that kind of thing. But I don't think they're going to do a great deal, really. I see Francis is saying a lot of pretty liberal things, but he's not moving on any of the big things. Like, he's made no move whatever now on clerical celibacy, and no sign whatever that he will. And one gets the feeling that clerical celibacy is part of the Catholic Church, and so it will remain. And there'll be no priest there in the very near future.
What about the concept of women as clergy?
There is no single reason why a woman cannot be ordained, except that the Church has not done it. But I suppose you could say also, well, Christ never did it, but is that a law forever, that because Christ didn't do it?
Father Good, a final question for you. If you could go back 50 years to July 1968,
yes,
would you do anything different?
Nothing, no. I was quite convinced of my position at the time. I suppose it was self-centred, but I was absolutely convinced. Mainly, I have no doubt, from my experience in the confessional.
The voice of Irish theologian Father James Good, who died at the age of 94 following a brief illness. Yeshte grev anam dealish. From all of us on the programme here this evening, goodbye.